From WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio, this is Lake Effect. I'm Mitch Tyke. Today on the show, we talk with County Executive Chris Abley about his proposed budget. Later, film critic Dave Lurson discusses The Patient Stone, set in a war-torn Central Asian country.
The film really captures the problems of that country, the ongoing decades and decades-long cycle of warfare, vengeance, recrimination.
Our sports contributor reintroduces us to the NBA team we may have forgotten.
They're really putting an emphasis on reaching out to fans that either gave up on the team or might not have been fans of the team in the first place. And of course, that's all well and good, but you've still got to put an entertaining product on the floor as well.
And we remember former Milwaukee Brave Andy Pafko, who died this week. Lake Effect comes your way next, after the news. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Milwaukee County leaders are already hearing from many people who stand to be affected by funding levels represented in the proposed county budget. County Executive Chris Abley offered his budget proposal late last month, which includes $1.3 billion in spending and no increase in property taxes. Abley has also been in the news in recent days with a proposal to turn over health care coverage for county employees to the health exchanges included in the Affordable Care Act. He's with us in the studio to talk about some of these issues. Welcome back to the show.
Great to be here.
Let's start with the issue that's gotten a fair amount of attention in recent days. You floated the idea that the county could get out of the business of providing health insurance to its employees and turn that business over to the newly created health exchanges. What do you see as compelling reasons to make that change?
Sure. Well, the only reason I look and explore any new way of doing something at the county is to see if I can provide better value for the people who work there and for the people who live in the county. As everybody knows, regardless of what people might think of policy-wise, the Affordable Care Act, it's law. I personally think we have a real opportunity as a country to find some efficiencies, and because there's the potential, I talked to a lot of people who know a lot about healthcare and said, let's explore the idea to see if we can provide the current or better level of care compared to what we currently do for county employees. If we can provide the same level or better and save money, then we would absolutely take advantage of that. So the way we wrote the budget assumes that we're going to continue the way we always have, but we essentially have what's like an asterisk that says, but we're going to explore the healthcare exchange here in Wisconsin. And if we can show the employees we can provide the same level of care or better and we can save money doing it, we are absolutely going to pursue that. And you know why? I'm always going to look to provide better care for employees and better value for taxpayers. So, and if it works, it works. If it doesn't, it doesn't. But we explore a lot of ideas, and that's how we've gotten a lot of the savings we've gotten over the years.
Well, what's the process for making that determination?
Sure. Well, we're working with I've talked to former Governor Doyle, who now works with the Kaiser Family Foundation and R.W. Johnson, a foundation in healthcare policy. Talked to David Reamer, who, as many folks know, knows about as much as healthcare exchanges as anybody. And does some work for the Urban Institute. And we've talked to our friends at Health and Human Services. We've been talking to the White House about this. I don't want to do this if anybody's going to, you know, have their feathers ruffled. And all of them understand the same idea. If we can make this work so employees would get better health care at a price that would be less to taxpayers, and then that savings can go back to continuing to do what we've been doing the last 2 years, which is try and restore programs, great. Let's look for it. And you know, it's a good enough idea. It's worth trying hard to see if we can make it work.
Well, and so let's talk about some of the other aspects to the budget you've proposed. One of the key elements is this public safety initiative.
Mm-hmm.
Give us a thumbnail sketch of the need that you see that speaking to.
Well, like every decision I've made since I've been in office has been my best effort at getting the best value for your dollar. And in this case, all what you see in our public safety initiative is a lot of money, and it's a lot of very specifically targeted investments. But I'll just say – start by saying we're not throwing darts. Every investment here, every dime that's being spent is based on data, research, analysis, programs that are similar and has – includes accountability. One of the things people will see is we're adding a lot of programming that didn't used to happen before at the House of Correction. So now where there used to be no programming at all, people can get GEDs. People can get job training, which dramatically reduces the likelihood that they'll recommit a crime, improves public safety, saves money because we don't have to pay for putting them up there. We're also doing volunteer work crews with the Hunger Task Force at the fish farm so inmates can lose can learn skills. They can be on cleanup crews for parks, cleanup crews for highways, which is services where they get experience. It saves cost to taxpayers. And all of this has an impact on public safety. We're actually – things you might not think about. We're adding two officers to Child Support Services. Child Support Services is the department that gets a check to moms who are trying to bring up kids on their own. And every time we can add one more mom to the list of someone who's getting a check every month, that's one more mom who is more likely to be able to stay with her family. Those kids are more likely to be able to stay in school and stay out of trouble with the law. And that absolutely has an impact on public safety. We're adding investigators, five, to the district attorney's office, again, based on their specific needs, leverage impact, filling a niche that isn't being filled. We have in the budget the funding for the Milwaukee Police Department's ShotSpotter. People will remember probably the police department was interested in this program. It's a cool technology, microphones. If a gun is fired in a very large area, instantly it can track the location of the gun, often the type of the gun. If there's multiple shots, the movement, that information goes immediately to squads who can respond, and response time matters and that sort of thing. People might ask, so why is the county picking up the cost for something that is in the police department, which is a city budget? Well, as I've been saying for a while, one of the most frustrating things when you're trying to solve public benefit problems is these artificial lines we put up between each other. And it turns out I live in the city. I also live in the county, and I also live in the state. It's the same people paying for these services. We're serving the same people. And if I can make an investment at county, wherever it is, if the benefit is going to accrue to people in the city, the county, the state, if it's our taxpayers, I'll do it. We did this, and we worked with the police department to get to it. The police department has been doing extra safety patrols on our transit system for 2 years now. They don't operate transit. We operate transit. They haven't sent us a bill. But as Chief Flynn would say, look, we all have to work together. And guess what? When we work together, we get to better solutions. Our public safety budget covers for that. It covers for training for the police department to deal with folks they deal with – they run into with mental illnesses. It pays for a full-time staffer to help those officers know where the placement opportunities we have, the right kind of treatment. This is something police departments have wanted for a long time. It means more time for squads patrolling, faster time between somebody being picked up with mental illness and the right kind of treatment, which means better outcomes for them, which means less time they're being dropped off at an emergency room expensively and with poor outcomes. All of this has an impact on public safety. But again, you know, if you look through that whole list of investments, what you're going to see, what they all have in common is we're not throwing darts. This is based on the highest return on public safety for your dollar, and we're not guessing, and we're going to hold these things accountable.
You mentioned transits, mm-hmm. and one of the issues that has been, I guess, in the background for some time mm-hmm. is the future of the contract to operate Milwaukee County Transit. How much do you think the success of your budget hinges on whether MV Transportation ends up with that budget versus continuing either with MTS or another company?
Sure. Well, you know, in terms of MV per se, the reason I did this, the reason I decided to look at this, just the quick history, the current provider started as a for-profit company that was pulled into the county in the 70s. We've had the same provider. The county has a contract. So we don't actually directly manage transit. MCTS does. We have the contract to the county. And the reason we put this out for bid is the same reason we do everything, to see if we can get an opportunity for somebody who could provide better service. It doesn't mean we necessarily change it. We encouraged MCTS to also put in a proposal. The only thing we said, we didn't predetermine a vendor. What we did was we want a contract that gives county and taxpayers more accountability. I think everybody would agree. You know, you read about $8 million too expensive contract that unfortunately from the county side we couldn't do too much about because that's not handled by us. There's been other issues as well. Regardless, we encourage the current provider, hey, submit a proposal. But what we told everybody who's going to provide, there's one thing we're measuring and that's the outcome. More rides, lower fares, better service, and more accountability to the taxpayers. If the only thing that changed was we stayed with MCTS but had a better contract which allowed us to hold them more accountable, then that alone would be great. MV, however, is a hell of a story. You know, if the fact that this is a company that was started by an African-American woman in Texas who started as a driver and now has one of the largest companies doing this sort of work in the country. She has a board of directors where every single member of the board started as a driver. They get it. They get what it's like from the front end to the back end and they provide great service. And I think the more people see what they be able to do and what this contract is about, the more they'll realize why we did this. But to be clear, you know, when I explore any new idea, can I guarantee it's going to be perfect? Nope. But I can guarantee if we don't look for the opportunity to improve, we're not going to. And I'm always going to look for the opportunity to improve.
Your budget calls for $3 million to continue the plan to fix long-neglected parks in urban areas. At the same time, It has come under some criticism for a plan to close two indoor pools and convert them to splash pads and indoor skate parks. The criticism goes that, you know, this is another example of struggling neighborhoods getting another strike against them and the further division of the county into a place with haves and have-nots. What's your response to that critique and how it relates to the additional money that you see going to the other parks?
It's a great question. I couldn't agree more that one of the issues in parks over the years is where we've deployed our capital investment. And there's a lot of suburban parks that have gotten some great investment, and that's great, and we're going to continue that. But as we started to address last year, there's a lot of parks in the city of Milwaukee for whom it's been a long time. They're overdue for work. And we're trying to address that. Yeah, the socioeconomic standards in a lot of these parks are not what they are around the suburbs, but that doesn't mean we don't need to address them. We absolutely do. So like last year, we are doing a lot of investment in parks in the city. And in terms of the indoor pools, that's a great question. The indoor pools they cost about $300,000 a year to operate. The two ones we're talking about replacing have about $4 million in maintenance. And the numbers for usage are declining. Yep, there are people who use them. But the good news is there's a lot of publicly operated pools. We've talked to the Milwaukee Public School System. They operate a lot, though they've got the same issue we do. They're expensive and usage is going down. The key here is that we're not removing pools. What we're doing is replacing them with amenities that lots more people use. Pools were built around the country, public pools, the big boom in the 50s. But if you talk to park systems around the country, things have changed a lot. You know, the reason you go to some of the aquatic facilities, you know, the splash pads with all the different things that you know, you see kids running around. The reason people like those, kids love them because they're used to lots of things to get their attention, having lots of activities. You know, we built pools when we didn't have the Dells and iPads and things to get your stimulate you constantly. And parents love the splash pads because their kids love them. The daycare facilities love them. But the idea is there will still be public pools. We'll be able to have an amenity that more people use. We will save a ton of operating money every year, and every dime of that is going back into parks. This isn't about expensively protecting the county of the past. This is about building a county for the future. 95 million people are in the millennials right now. Those are 29 and under. That's a third of the population of this country. We need to build a county that's ready for them. And every single day I wake up, I look at everything we do at County and think not just can I do more, better, for less. I think can we do the right thing for the population now? And that's the idea here. People aren't wrong to, you know, like old pools. I like if you and I were talking about what's our favorite car, we'd say, you know, a Jaguar E-Type. Beautiful. Thing is, you can fit two people in. The mileage isn't so great and they're in the shop all the time. If it's taxpayer money and it's about transportation, I'll get a minivan. I'm going to get good mileage, the safest car I can. I'm going to be boring and get you the best value. And that's what we're talking about here. Nobody wants to decrease. We want to increase the amount of people we're serving in the parks, and that's what this is about.
Chris Abley, thanks.
Great to be here. Thanks, Mitch.
Chris Abley is Milwaukee County Executive. You'll find more of our conversation and a link to Abley's proposed FY 2014 budget from WUWM.com/Lake Effect. A quick break now, and then our film contributor joins us to look at a trio of films, including one that Sir Isaac Newton would have been a big fan of. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Teich. It's been a while since an outer space film has attracted the sort of attention that George Clooney and Sandra Bullock's new film has. You could say that it has sort of a gravitational pull. That is, of course, a not-so-great joke, because the film is called Gravity, and it's encouraging comparisons to Stanley Kubrick's classic 2001: A Space Odyssey. Film contributor Dave Lurson spoke with Lake Effect's Dan Harmon about Gravity and two other films, which they hope will not be eclipsed by the blockbuster. Lurson talked about the ubiquitous comparisons to Kubrick's 1968 masterpiece.
I think it's very difficult for a filmmaker doing a premium production set in outer space to entirely evade the influence of 2001, A Space Odyssey, the great Stanley Kubrick film from the late 1960s. Especially since the director of Gravity, Alfonso Cuarón, grew up utterly enamored of the space program of that era. He had photographs of cosmonauts and astronauts in his bedroom by his own account. He was also, you know, an avid film goer from a fairly young age. He must have seen the movie probably more than once. Comparing the two is a little bit unfair, because I don't think that Gravity is some sort of 21st century take on 2001. It has different themes going on. But the sense of vastness of infinity, the marvelous breakthrough use of technology in service to a story set in space, I would find it hard to believe that Gravity's director didn't have Kubrick a little bit in mind while making this film.
And still, it seems, I mean, I just read someone compared it. I don't remember who it was that they made the comparison, and I'm just thinking, well, there's plenty of drifting in space kind of either movies or television shows or comedies. I mean, even Red Dwarf, you know, they're drifting in space on a mining ship. So it seems like a little narrow just to focus and compare it to one movie.
Well, it is, but I think that maybe up to this point, no one has done it better than Kubrick. There are just, you know, of course, tons of science fiction movies. Some of them do not deal with a sense of being outside the space vessels. Many space movies are contained within the vessel, so you have that as a point of distinction. Many, you know, science fiction films assume a distant future where all the technical problems have been solved, like all the various Star Trek and Star Wars movies. I mean, it's just, you know, very easy apparently to get from one point of the galaxy to another. So you can exclude all of that, and you can exclude all kinds of very second-tier derivative films. And you have probably, and it's always risky to talk about the history of filmmaking in relation to a film that came out 2 weeks ago. I would be willing to bet a quarter, at least, because I'm not much of a betting man, that 20 years from now, historians will look back at Gravity and 2001 and speak of them in the same breath, 2001 being obviously the pathfinder, but Gravity being a very good heir to this kind of filmmaking.
And at the same time, it's technically interesting to look at, and it's set in space. it's still a human drama. It's I believe they're the only two, right? The only two actors in the movie.
Right. And you hear some voices, but you don't see anyone else.
So it's about their lives and their interaction and their past and maybe their future.
Yeah, a little bit about the past, enough to get a sense for the characters, I suppose. Really, the theme of this film is the indomitable possibilities of the human spirit. And here I think that the director, who also wrote the movie with his son, lays down a little thick at times that maybe a more subtle touch would have appealed to me more. But Sandra Bullock is the protagonist in this movie. She is the major star. George Clooney is a kind of, not sidekick by any means, but a kind of facilitator or inspirational figure. Without his words of wisdom, the Sandra Bullock character probably would have met a very bad end early on in this film.
Anything noteworthy as far as their acting in this movie? And you think this is an Oscar contender, yeah?
I think it's an Oscar contender. It'd be very, very difficult to imagine Sandra Bullock not being nominated for Best Actress. It'd be very hard to imagine that the nominating committees wouldn't consider Gravity for Best Picture and Cuarón for Best Director. Clooney might get Best Supporting Actor. I think under the Academy's rules, he would be considered a supporting actor in this movie. But of course, I mean, it's the leading movie right now going into Oscar season for nominations. But there are quite a few other very fine-looking movies in the months ahead, so we'll have to wait until early next year to know for sure.
All right. Well, I want to talk about another movie, which probably won't be an Oscar contender. I don't know. Maybe you disagree with me, and that's Don John. And what's interesting is that Joseph Gordon-Levitt is the star, but he's also the writer and the director of it, I believe.
Yes, it's a contemporary iteration of the Don Juan story. Here, the king of one-nighters is kind of a Brooklyn boy. Some of the Brooklyn Italian stereotypes are almost squeamish to a degree. He's a porno junkie. He prefers watching hardcore porn on his laptop over actual sexual encounters, though he has those too, but they just never quite measure up to the fantasies that he enjoys while watching pornography. Really, I have a problem with this movie. It's the same old Hollywood thing that goes back to Cecil B. DeMille in the 1920s. You take a kind of moral stance against something while reveling in it for about 98% of the film. I see that old tendency at work in Don John. What I really enjoyed about this movie most, though, was Scarlett Johansson as the Brooklyn girlfriend of the Gordon-Levitt character. If anybody had any doubts about her ability and her range, I think you can put them aside. She was extremely convincing as this kind of character, much more so, I think, than Gordon-Levitt was.
Well, it's a pretty radical departure, I think, from his previous roles.
Yeah, well, he's trying something different. I mean, that's commendable. Will this be an Oscar bait kind of a movie? I have a feeling. I would guess right now, no.
All right.
I think there are just so many other more Oscar-like movies on the way that it probably will be left out.
Still, I think it's probably the first mainstream movie to deal with porn addiction. I don't think anyone else has really touched it in this way.
Well, not in such a graphic way, certainly. I don't know. That's an interesting question. Google mainstream sex addiction movies and see if anything else comes up. I don't know. I guess you're correct. I can't think of another movie that deals with this quite so explicitly.
And so frank about
Yes, it.
Yeah.
It is definitely a frank film.
All right. And for another radical switch, we both saw the preview for The Patient's Stone, which is a movie, well, it's set in Afghanistan. It's kind of hard to say it's so multinational where the cast and crew and filming locations are.
Yeah, the crew was mostly French. The director, Atiq Rahimi, is an Afghan who's been living abroad in France primarily for many, many years now. The movie was filmed, I believe, primarily in Morocco, which is a good stand-in for Afghanistan. Interestingly, the name Afghanistan or any location within that country were never explicitly mentioned. But I think anyone knowing anything about Afghanistan would recognize it right away, particularly for the burqas that the women in the movie are forced to wear when going out of doors. It really couldn't be anywhere else but Afghanistan.
I didn't even think it was anywhere else when I was watching it. And at the end of the movie, I was thinking to myself, wow, someone could lose their lives over this movie because it's just so out there as far as the subject matter. If it was filmed there, it certainly would be.
Yeah, I think filming a movie of this kind in Afghanistan, probably filming anything beyond a short newscast might be dangerous work in Afghanistan right now, too. But the film really captures the problems of that country, the ongoing decades and decades long cycle of warfare, vengeance, recrimination, the state of open conflict, armed conflict between just, where does a militia become a group of bandits? Where does extreme forms of piety become hypocrisy? The movie examines so many different things very well. Wonderful cast of actors. I don't think that most people in America, I'm certainly not familiar with the backgrounds of the cast of this film. I do know that there are a lot of folkloric Afghani elements woven into the story. So it's a beautifully filmed piece of work, too. Excellent cinematography. Well worth the interest of anyone who cares about beautiful filmmaking nowadays, as opposed to simply pointing a digital camera at something and hoping for the best. And anyone concerned with the ongoing problems of that part of the world.
Yeah, when I heard the description, I thought, oh, maybe I'll be underwhelmed. And the gist is that a wife is taking care of her husband who is basically in a coma,
right,
but in their home. There's nowhere to take him. So she reveals her secrets to him, and that's one of the folklore.
They were never able to have a meaningful conversation before. It's a trifle right. One-sided, this conversation, because he can't hear, it seems, or if he can, he's unable to respond. But she feels finally free to talk to a man that she was betrothed to, probably not entirely, of her own free will. He went off to fight in some of the various wars that overtook that country. He was considered a hero, but he received a bullet in the neck over some small, petty conflict that had nothing to do with the larger problems of the country. An ironic touch, I think.
Yeah. And then it's not just her telling a story, but the use of flashbacks, of course, really made it a bit more interesting and textured. More than just a story telling.
Yeah, it's a great film. I'm not sure if it's eligible for a foreign language Oscar. It should be. It's sort of one of these multinational productions. Even Germany, I think, has kicked in some money for it. So where do you place it exactly? But I would call it an Afghan movie, even though it wasn't filmed there. And even though the director, who is an Afghan, hasn't lived in the country for 30 years, apparently.
Mm. All right. Well, the other interesting thing about it that I found was that there was no mention of foreigners or troops from other countries there. This was very much about the themselves and their own militia.
Yeah. And I found that to be very, very interesting because there was no sort of blame game going on, if you will. No excuse coming from the outside for what was going on there, the problem, whatever its roots has devolved into this crisis among the people who have to live together, hopefully, in that country.
All right. Well, we talked about three movies. Maybe there's something there for everyone, maybe one. Thanks for coming in, Dave.
Thank you.
Dave Larson is arts and entertainment editor of the Shepherd Express Weekly and writes the I Hate Hollywood blog. He spoke with Dan Harmon about Gravity, Don John, and The Patient Stone. The last of those movies opens tonight. Sports contributor Howie Magner stops by after a break to look ahead at the Bucks season on a newly designed basketball court. We will also talk Packers and the baseball pennant race. Keep listening. This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. more of Lake Effect Now. I'm Mitch Teich. We talked on yesterday's show about the controversy surrounding calls for a new basketball arena in downtown Milwaukee. No matter what happens in the future, the Bucks are certain to open this season on the road. At the end of the month, before returning to the BMO Harris Bradley Center for their home opener in early November, Howie Magner is our regular sports contributor, and he's here to perhaps reintroduce us to the team on the hardwood over at the Bradley Center. Nice to see you again.
Mitch, it's always good to be here.
The two of us actually not long ago met up at the Art Museum, of all places, which seems like a somewhat unlikely place for us to run into each other.
Well, you wanted to go look at sculptures, and I was interested in the Renoirs and the Monets, and okay, that's not really true.
But we both happened to be there when there were a lot of basketball fans there.
Yeah.
The Milwaukee Bucks were unveiling their new floor inspired by their old floor. What is this all about? What difference does the Bucks floor circa 2013 make?
It's been very interesting to kind of watch the Bucks over the past 5 months basically try to reintroduce themselves entirely to the city of Milwaukee and to their fan base in general. And part of the reason for that is that I know you had Doug Russell on talking about the push to build a new arena to replace the Bradley Center. And to do that, I think the Bucks have to really start to generate some more goodwill. And of course, you do that partially by winning games. And so they'll certainly try to do that. But they're also trying to get a little bit creative, I think, in how they reach out to fans in other ways. And I really do think the repainting of the floor is one of those ways they can do it. And they can do it without regards to what type of success they have on that floor. So, you know, there was a really nostalgic feeling to kind of hearkening back to the whole Robert Indiana design Mecca floor. And that really inspired the Bucks to look at, could we riff off of that with the current floor? And so they had kind of a whole quick redesign process, and they had to get it approved by the league and jump through all these hoops. And they even went out on this like this quest to get Robert Indiana's approval of this. And so it's kind of this whole quest to get back to the past and to maybe reconnect with fans in a way that they haven't done in the past. And I think they did a pretty good job with it, really. I guess the league rules dictate just how out there they can get with court designs. But I thought what they came up with was very sleek, and it hearkened enough back to the past while keeping it modern enough that it was pretty neat. This was just one of the things that they've done to try to, you know, I guess I don't want to say get back in fans' good graces, but to really kind of generate some excitement among the fans and people in Milwaukee. Another thing they did was they had this Bucks Fan Fest. They had their players there doing autographs, and you could take pictures with them, and I guess there was a booth where you could be a sportscaster and play games and I presume buy season tickets as well. You may as well sell tickets while you're there. But from what I hear, it was a pretty good success. I guess 5,000 or so people showed up, and which isn't bad for a thing that was kind of put together on short notice.
And for something that wasn't a game.
Exactly. So they're really putting an emphasis on reaching out to fans that either gave up on the team or might not have been fans of the team in the first place. And of course, that's all well and good, but you've still got to put an entertaining product on the floor as well.
Well, and so in the spirit of the Bucks reintroducing themselves in a way to fans, let's introduce our listeners to some of the people that we ought to know about, starting with a guy from Greece who's actually generating a lot of excitement across the Atlantic anyway.
What's his name, Mitch?
Giannis.
I'll help you out. I'll bail you out here because I've been practicing. Giannis Antetokounmpo, 18 years
old. I believe my
prescription
for that has expired.
That's right. Well, good. Maybe he'll get you another one. Giannis Antetokounmpo was the Bucks' first-round draft pick this season, and he's 18 years old and fresh as the spring rain, let me tell you. He'd never been out of Greece but one time before the Bucks drafted him. And a lot of people think he's going to be kind of a developmental project. He was only playing in like the Greece second division. Has very little professional experience, but he's got unbelievable athletic potential. He's what they call a point forward in the making, and that's a guy who's 6'9" but can handle the ball like a point guard, and just is able to do a lot of things that other players without those gifts can't do. The thing is, you don't want to put too much on this kid too soon. I don't think he's ready to play a major role on the team just yet. And Giannis is only one of 11 new faces on this team. They've basically completely turned the roster over. There's only four guys left on this year's team who were on last year's 15-man roster. That's John Henson, Larry Sanders, Ersan Ilyasova, and Epe Udo. And everybody else is new. So, again, this kind of goes into reintroducing themselves to the community with this new team. And I think part of the reason was not necessarily that the guys they had on the team last year weren't talented, but the locker room wasn't really a good place. They didn't get along. There was very poor chemistry. There was questions about whether their stars from last year still wanted to be here in Milwaukee. And from all accounts after they left, and the guys we're mainly talking about here are Brandon Jennings and Monte Ellis, they wanted to go. Monte Ellis made a big deal at his new team in Dallas, saying how unhappy he was in Milwaukee. Brandon Jennings was complimentary of how he's finally got players around him and he doesn't have to carry the load and take all those bad shots. Those guys just have not been very nostalgic about their days in Milwaukee.
Hopefully they don't need to come back here and ask for a job at some point.
Well, they might very well, or maybe they wouldn't even do it. But I tell you this, I can't imagine the Bucks would take them back. So, and one of the things the Bucks really put an emphasis on when going out and looking for new players this offseason was character, was chemistry, was guys who were going to get along. They want a team of good guys who are going to really buy into this whole team ideal that Larry Drew, the new Bucks coach, wants to push and thinks is a real ingredient when it comes to success. And so out at Bucks Media Day, basically every guy that stood in front of the mic, every player, every front office personnel man, even Herb Cole, stood up and said how important chemistry was to success on the floor. And the players are the same thing. We're brothers. We'll sacrifice individual goals for the team. It's really been a preseason point of emphasis. And I think one of the guys who's really taken that leadership role to heart is Caron Butler. The Racine native who went off and played, had a very good career in other places, is kind of on the downside of his career now. He's in his 30s, but still has something left to contribute and still has a lot of leadership left to contribute. One of the things he did before the season was he took everybody out to dinner just to get to know them better, just to kind of begin building that team chemistry. So they're really counting on that to be a key ingredient to the team's success this year. Personally, I don't think on paper they're quite as talented as they were last year, but I really believe they're going to have a lot more team chemistry. I think the locker room is going to be a much more inviting place to be if you're a player. It'll be interesting to see how that trade-off balances out when it comes to trying to have a better record from last year.
Let's shift gears quickly. We have a little time left and talk about the Packers and the review of their most recent game, which I think we can just say they won.
Well, that's the positive, right? People, it's been real interesting watching the Packers this season because, everybody thinks that their offense should be one of the best in the league. They went out and really invested heavily in redoing the running game, and they've got three of the best wide receivers in the game. And, of course, they've got one of the best quarterbacks in the game as well. But the offense just hasn't seemed to fire on all cylinders yet. And that was really the case against Detroit. They won the game. But they struggled to score points. They didn't get a touchdown until the third quarter, I believe. For a while, it looked like Mason Crosby was going to be their most valuable player of the game. And Mason Crosby's actually an interesting story because in the preseason, everybody couldn't wait to get rid of this guy. And here, he's been one of the most consistent pieces on offense. The Packers just haven't looked like themselves. And whether or not injuries have something something to do with it or whether it's the offensive line that hasn't gelled in the wake of those injuries. Something just doesn't seem like it's clicked quite yet.
The good news, maybe it will click.
That's exactly right. You know that they're talented and there's still plenty of time left in this season. And the defense has been a bit of a work in progress as well. They really looked good against Detroit. Some people would say part of the reason they look good against Detroit is because Detroit didn't have the best receiver in the game in Calvin Johnson. But the Packers defense is going to face some challenges of its own now with the injury to Clay Matthews, who's basically their best player on defense, and he's going to be out for a month with a broken thumb. He just had surgery this past week. So, the game against Detroit was really a must-win game because had they lost that game, they would have fallen three games back in the division, and really their only path to the playoffs after that would have been a wild card berth. In winning it, they even their record at 2-2. They bring Detroit back to the pack a little bit, and they're right back in the division race. So I still think they're the favorite to win the division, but I do think they're going to have to play better to get there. They've just been making some uncharacteristic mistakes. You would think that as the season goes along, that will cease to happen. Mike McCarthy's teams generally have improved as this season goes along, and assuming that trend holds, the Packers should be fine.
Howie, thanks.
Thanks, Mitch. Take care.
Howie Magner writes the Sports Nut column for Milwaukee Magazine's website, and he is senior editor of the magazine and our regular sports contributor. One last break, and then we will remember the late, great Andy Pafko. This is Lake Effect on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Teich. As we mentioned before the break, former Milwaukee Brave Andy Pafko has died. The native of Boyceville, Wisconsin, played outfield and occasionally third base for 17 seasons. He played in both of the Milwaukee Braves' trips to the World Series. He also played for the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 1952 World Series and for the Chicago Cubs in their last trip to the series in 1945. Along the way, his teammates included players like Jackie Robinson, Hank Aaron, Duke Snyder, and Eddie Matthews. We had a chance to visit with Andy Pafko at his home in northern Illinois 4 years ago as he reminisced about his playing days, starting with how he got his nickname, Handy Andy.
Well, I guess I played a number of positions. You know, I played the infield, the outfield, so that's probably why I got my name, Handy Andy, and it stuck with me.
You first started playing baseball, like before you were even in the major leagues, the story of... Were you in Little League or were you in high school? When did you start playing baseball?
Well, I started playing ball in high school, and some of the people that knew the game told me to go to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. We had a professional baseball team, and I went there for a tryout, and I got signed a professional contract, but I was sent home because the roster was full, so I figured, well, there goes my career. I'll be forgotten about. But I did go home and play around my hometown, and there was about a month left of the season in the Northern League in Eau Claire, and this brand new car came into my parents' driveway. I said, "Who is this?" And I was the manager of the Eau Claire Bears. He still remembered me, and he came and he says, "So why don't you take your clothes and we're going to go to Eau Claire. We're going to finish the season," which I did, and that was my first start in the big leagues.
You came up to the big leagues in 1943, and you played until 1959. How fresh in your mind are those days of your playing days still in 2009?
Well, I still remember those were the good old days, and of course I played for a long time, a number of years, and I was so fortunate that I played for three different clubs, and all the three clubs went into the World Series. And I think of a guy like Ron Santo played all those years and never had the opportunity here. I played with on three clubs, and we all went to the World Series. So how lucky could I get? So I had a good career. I'm very lucky.
Do you remember your first game as a major leaguer?
Well, I think I do. I think the first time I came up to the plate, I hit a base hit, and of course that took the pressure off right away because you know trying to get that big league hit is awesome, but I took the burden off my shoulders, and then from then on became history.
Do you remember what it was like to be traded from the Cubs to the Dodgers?
Well, that's part of baseball, but I soon found out. I mean, to me, that was a big shock. I thought I was, you know, well established in Chicago, and all of a sudden, here I am, a Dodger. So, and of course, I was lucky. I played there for a number of years, and then, of course, I was traded to the Boston Braves, who became the Milwaukee Braves, and that was another big break for me. I came home to finish my career as a big leaguer. So, I had a very lucky career.
It must have seemed pretty lucky, not only to have when you were traded to the Braves, they were the Boston Braves, and just a short time later, they announced they were moving to Milwaukee.
That was the biggest break in my career. I think I got a chance to play big league baseball in my home state.
And you said you went home to finish your career, but you actually played, six seasons in Milwaukee. Is that right? Five or six seasons?
I can't recall how many seasons, but I did play the longest in my career with the Milwaukee and stayed on as a coach, so that helped my career.
I'm curious because you played at a really interesting time as baseball was becoming integrated, and you actually had a chance to play with Jackie Robinson when you were both on the Dodgers, and then you played with Hank Aaron when you were both on the Milwaukee Braves. Let's talk about the Dodgers first, if we could. What was the atmosphere like between the black players and the white players?
Their thoughts would, but I consider myself the luckiest guy in the world to play in the big leagues, and especially when the colored people came in, you know, I mean, probably a lot of people didn't like the color that came in, but they were given the opportunity. They had the experience and the knowledge to play the game, and I wished them well, and I was just glad to play with great athletes such as Jackie Robinson and the rest of them.
What was Hank Aaron like? What was it? He must have been under an incredible amount of pressure being the star that he was.
Just being around Hank Aaron was a great honor. I mean, I never thought I'd be that lucky to play with such a great ball player like he was. So,
well, and you were there when he was a rookie, when you were the veteran by then, and he walked in the clubhouse, and I guess it was 1954 was his rookie year.
He looked like a ball player. He built like a ball player, you know. So I don't know if I was built like a ball player. I was a farm boy, you know. I started on a farm where Hank Aaron, he became a great player and of his stature. So I was very fortunate to play with a guy like him.
Strange question, but you're 88 years old. The last time you played in a major league game was 50 years ago. Do your hands still remember what it felt like to hit a home run?
No, I never gave it a thought. I mean, if I hit a home run, I was just lucky. I never considered myself a home run hitter. I was a good contact hitter, and I had a pretty good eye for baseball, if it balls or strikes. So I was known for that in that regard.
Who was the hardest pitcher to face?
No question in my mind, the greatest pitcher that had a toughest time was Ewell Blackwell of Cincinnati Reds. I mean, every time we came to Cincinnati or they came to Milwaukee, I was glad when he was in pitching, because I know the day he was pitching, I got my 0-for-4. So to me, he was the toughest pitcher. But of course, there's a lot of great pitchers. But to me, Ewell Blackwell was number one of Cincinnati.
His nickname was the Whip, I think.
Yeah, right. He called him the Whip, and he really whipped it.
What about the parks? What was your favorite place to play?
Well, I enjoyed playing in Brooklyn and, of course, Cubs Park, you know. But I hated to play in a polo ground because I was more of a straightaway hitter. If you were a pull hitter, you were blessed because it was short down the line. But my power was more to left center and right center. So especially in New York, it was an automatic out. But I was very lucky to play in New York.
Right. The polo grounds had center field and was like 500 feet out.
Oh man, it was just a long walk. I mean, let alone to play in it. Let's put it that way.
Before we started recording, we were talking about the amount of money that baseball players make today. Can you talk about what it was like to earn a living playing baseball in the 40s and 50s? You actually had to have a part-time job as well during the off season, right?
Well, I always had a part-time job. I never really made that big money. I mean, especially in those days before TV came along, and of course that changed the whole change system.
What were the kinds of part-time jobs that you worked when you weren't on the ball field?
I always got part-time jobs, you know, a little bit here, a little bit there, but nothing great. So I just had enough good enough job to stay to keep my name informed.
Major league teams travel on their own private jets today, and they stay in the best hotels and eat at the best restaurants. What was traveling as a major leaguer like in the 1940s and 50s?
Well, we used to travel by train. It's not like today. I mean, everything is first class. I mean, I wish I was playing today with my ability that I had, but the game has changed a lot.
How else do you think, obviously you're not playing anymore, how else, but as somebody who watches the game, how else do you think the game has changed?
Money. One word, just money. I mean, the game has changed a lot. I mean, since like I said, when I played, I loved the game. I would have played it for nothing, like my wife did said. But baseball became a great sport, and I'm glad I was involved in it as a player, as a coach, and now as a fan. I still love the game. It is the most wonderful game that I could have chosen in my lifetime.
How did you know when it was time to retire? You'd played for the Braves from 53 to 59, and 59 was your last year. How did you know it was time to step back and go from playing to coaching?
Well, I think every player knows when it's coming to an end, because you can't do the thing that you can't do the things that you used to do. You know, getting on base and running here, running there. So it's a tough life to be in baseball as long as I have. And I consider myself a lucky guy to play as long as I have and met so many great people in a game of baseball.
Do you remember watching because you had played with Hank Aaron for so many years, when he hit that home run in 1974 and number 715, he broke Babe Ruth's record? Was it something special for you, having actually played with Hank Aaron that many years before?
No, I never thought. I was just lucky to be on the same club to play with a great player of his talent, namely, you know, Hank Aaron. And not only he was a great player, but he's a great individual. And I'm glad I had the opportunity to see him on both sides of the fence. You know, I just love the guy. I'm glad I played with him, and that's about all I can say.
Former Milwaukee Brave, Brooklyn Dodger, and Chicago Cub Andy Pafko speaking with us in 2009. Pafko died Tuesday at a nursing home in Michigan at the age of 92. That's all for another week's worth of Lake Effects. We're produced by Dan Harmon, Stephanie Lecce, and Bonnie North, with able assistance from Eleanor Peterson and Nathan Royster. John Stralecki is our studio engineer. I'm Mitch Teich. Hope you have a terrific weekend, and I hope we can be part of your weekend. Lake Effect Weekend airs Saturday and Sunday afternoon at 3, right here on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Stay tuned. Fresh Air is next. It's 11 o'clock.